Hi everyone, thank you for listening to Lit Radio podcast once again. This is your host, Thea. Today, I'm joined by Jennifer Sundberg and Pippa Beck to talk about their book, Collective Intelligence, How to Build a Business That's Smarter Than You. Jennifer and Pippa are co-CEOs of Board Intelligence, a leading provider of business reporting software. To date, they have supported more than 3,000 organizations and 40,000 leaders to unleash board performance and collective intelligence. In their book, Collective Intelligence, the authors show how the world's most enduringly successful businesses aren't reliant on a superstar CEO or executive team. They empower everyone, from the boardroom to the shop floor, to think hard and act fast by systematically building three capabilities: critical thinking, great communication, and a shared focus on what matters most. So hi, Jennifer and Pippa. It's a great pleasure to have you with us on Lit Radio podcast today to speak about your new book, Collective Intelligence. But before we do that, let's begin with a little background about your work as co-CEOs. So, Pippa, let's start with you on this one. What is it like running a company with a co-CEO?
Yeah, so good question. So when Jen and I first met and started working together, we didn't actually have the co-CEO models. I suppose our business model at the time more looked and felt like consulting. So it was almost like we were partners. But as the business grew and as we pivoted and became a technology firm, wisdom and convention of tech firms is you have a CEO. So we decided that we would be co-CEOs. We co-run the business together, and we'd share essentially the title. And it has so many benefits to it. Not least, it won't escape you that we're both women. We started the business in our 20s. So we've gone through the childbearing age of being women, and being able to take maternity leave, like proper maternity leave, and hand the baton to each other as we go has been really important. And I'm not too sure how we would have done it otherwise. So we have 5 children under 7 between the two of us and have managed to run the business throughout. So that's been one massive plus. But irrespective of being women and mothers, just the co-CEO model enables you to divide and conquer in so many different ways. So if you think about the role of a chief exec, it's huge. You're meant to be running of the business of today whilst building the business of tomorrow. Those are two very different things. And sometimes when you can divide and conquer on them, that makes it much easier. For our business, a tech business, we've got everything happening on the customer and commercial side whilst we've got everything happening on product and product development and technology. And again, being able to divide and conquer has been brilliant. And I suppose the final point that's really important is that, and that Jen and I both learned about each other, is we think in quite different ways and we approach things in quite different ways. And whenever there is a difficult decision to be made, actually being able to talk through that decision with each other, we always end up in a better place. So, Jen will always have a perspective that I won't have thought of that will make me think more broadly about an issue, and vice versa. I think some people will criticize the model sometimes and say, doesn't that make it slow? If every time you need to take a big decision, you need to consult with each other and kind of go around the houses a bit on the logic, doesn't it make it slow? It's like, well, 99% of the time we're dividing and conquering and being able to do much more than a single person would do. And the 1% of the time you've got a really difficult decision to take and it takes longer because, you know, you're sparring with someone else, it helps you get to a better decision. And it's sometimes poor decisions that can cause businesses to take a massive step back or go slowly. So over time, we're huge fans. And then the final thing I'd say is, I think it protects us from the hubristic traits that can catch CEOs out. So that working with someone, valuing their opinion, valuing their thought, knowing that someone else is going to broaden your perspective, I think is really important in keeping one grounded and rooted and always wanting to collaborate with your team rather than becoming too siloed in one's thoughts and the power that you hold.
Yeah, that's absolutely fascinating. And it seems you really managed to make this work out for you really well. So, Jennifer, my next question would be for you. So before we even start talking about the book, could you define for us what collective intelligence is?
Yeah, happily. So collective intelligence is about empowering everyone in your organization, everyone, not just the leadership team, not just the co-CEOs, not just the board, empowering everyone to think well and take decisions. So it means building a business that is systematically designed to tap into the combined thinking power of its people. And we set out in the book all about how you create the conditions for this. But essentially, it boils down to equipping everyone with three capabilities and then building a whole host of habits and rituals around those three capabilities to make it really stick. Those three capabilities are, first of all, critical thinking skills. Secondly, great communication skills. Great thinking without great communication just withers on the vine. And thirdly, focus on what matters most, a shared focus, so that all of that thinking power, all of that energy is directed towards a common goal.
Yeah, absolutely. And then why did you decide to write the book Collective Intelligence? People, let's go with you on that.
So I think one of the things that's been a privilege, and it's probably fairly unique about our business, is the number of boardrooms that Jen and I have both observed through the years. So we'll observe each of us hundreds of board meetings. So we've got 3,000 clients, and those range from Fortune 50 to central governments through to, you know, your local school at the end of the road and every governance structure in between. And I think at the beginning, we would have, if you'd asked us to guess, we would have said that some of the traits and characteristics of those meetings, of those conversations, would be wildly different because of the difference in organizations. But actually, one of the things that we learned was there was much more that was similar and common, actually, to them than was different. And through those learnings, I think we wanted to take those learnings. We wanted to be able to open source them, share them with a broader community. But I suppose one thing that's important is, again, through the exposure to our clients, boardrooms, I'm going to say, and below, their executive teams and their leadership teams, we learned that as well, some of the principles that we are advocating aren't just useful for boards. So there's the reason that the book isn't called Board Intelligence, it's called Collective Intelligence. And that's because the principles that we talk about in the book benefit everyone. So they benefit executive teams, they benefit management teams, they benefit even, you know, even your small little kind of team meeting that you might have on a weekly basis. And we know that if you get these principles right across the organization, then you don't end up with essentially the bottlenecks that can happen, decision bottlenecks at the executive and the board level. And I suppose where you get to is this ultimately a much more delegated kind of model where decisions can be taken close to the shop floor. And we're all great fans of John Timpson from the kind of Timpson chain. He always talks about his upside down management model, whereas those in the shops are, you know, right closest to the customers, those are the people that are empowered to take everyday decisions.
Yeah, that's absolutely fascinating. And when I was going through the book, what really caught my attention was the fact that you're debunking quite a lot of the myths that come from Silicon Valley, especially. You speak about the star CEO and how we are made to believe usually one star CEO is responsible for the success of a company. But surely, Jen, this can't explain why those fast-moving big companies out there are succeeding so quickly. You know, the giants of the Silicon Valley who are well known for their genius CEOs, whether that's Steve Jobs or Mark Zuckerberg. So how would you explain that?
Yeah, so the opposite of collective intelligence and the opposite of the thesis we set out in the book would probably go something like this, you know, go hire a genius superstar CEO and then get out of their way so they can move fast and break things. Let's empower them to make all of the big calls, and let's get everybody else in the firm rowing, you know, in sync behind them, just executing as instructed, right? And you know, Walter Isaacson has his fabulous new biography of Elon Musk that's just come out, and this really, I think, somewhat reignites the conversation around the superstar CEO formula. It helps to fan the flames of this as the model to aspire to. But when you scratch below the surface of many of these Silicon Valley behemoths, the really big success stories out there, when you scratch below the surface of these companies that would appear to be led by this all-powerful superstar CEO, what you find actually looks very different to what you see on the surface. So let me give you some examples. Steve Jobs, Apple, phenomenal business leader, but he didn't come up with the idea for the iPhone. He actually had to be persuaded, and it took quite some time. Warren Buffett, extraordinary, you know, extraordinary individual, but it wasn't his idea to place a massive bet on Apple as an investment, as a stock. In fact, he didn't like the idea at all. It was one of his lieutenants who persuaded him that this is a really good idea. This is something we should do. Jeff Bezos didn't come up with every good idea at Amazon. He wasn't the one who came up with the idea for Amazon Prime, which has been credited with a big part of their story. And I was chatting to Anne Hyatt a few months ago, and she was the right-hand woman of Jeff Bezos in the early days. And she went on to become chief of staff to Eric Schmidt at Google. And she said this to me. She said, for sure, the confidence and the vision of these larger-than-life chief execs, it's incomparable. But they also think hard about how to help others think well. And unquestionably, that is why they have been as successful as they are. So the truth is, these phenomenal business leaders, and they are truly phenomenal, but they don't have all the answers. They can't be everywhere at once, solving every problem, spotting every opportunity. If they try to be, they create a massive bottleneck, and their organization will move at a snail's pace. In this day and age, you know, it's the fast that eat the slow, not the big that eat the small. You can't afford that to happen. And in the end, excessive concentrations of power make you stupid, right? You know, whether it's, you know, from Icarus to, you know, pick your scandal of the last few weeks or months or years, you know, plenty of times over and over, history reminds us that it's a very flawed model.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And it was really fascinating to read about it in the book. But now let's dig deeper into the book content. And as you, Jennifer, mentioned a little bit earlier, it is separated into three main parts, each working at one of the three capabilities that create the conditions for collective intelligence in a company. So the first one of those is thinking. And in the book, you say it is very important for everyone in an organization to ask good questions, although that's easier said than done. So Jennifer, could you tell us why is it so vital for everyone to ask good questions, and then how can we achieve that?
Sure. So the playbook that we've developed over the years and what we share in the book is called the Question-Driven Insight Principle, or QDI for short. And yes, it's, you know, as you mentioned, questions are, we're really big on questions, and questions are at the heart of this, because questions are the catalyst of critical thinking. They're the spark and the fuel of curiosity, of creativity. There's a quote from Stephen Hawking that I think has made its way into the book, which would say, you know, he says, "I'm just a child who has never grown up. I just keep asking these how and why questions, and occasionally I find an answer." You know, questions, they're the starting gun for great thinking. We give an example of this in the book of how this converts to business reality. We share an example. I'll try and keep it brief here, but an American football coach, Dwayne Douglas, he is stood on the touchline watching his American football team battle it out. And all of a sudden this question pops into his mind: why don't players urinate more? You know, in the course of a game, how come they don't need to use the facilities? And even at halftime, the locker room goes strangely unused. So it all started with a question. It then went on, this discovery of his, to uncover the role of electrolytes in how you regulate the body. And it ends up with him creating a new drink, a drink that he calls Gatorade, his team, the Florida Gators, inspired that one, and it opened up a multi-million-dollar business, a whole new segment called the energy drinks market. But it all started with a question. So to build collective intelligence, to get everyone in your organization thinking deeper, thinking harder, thinking better, we all need to get better at asking questions. The good news is we're born questioners, right? So Harvard University has done a study that shows that under the age of about five, between about 2 and 5 years old, a child will typically ask about 100 questions a day. But by the time you get to suddenly your professional career, by the time you leave school, the effects of that education system beats it out of us. And we start to place more and more emphasis and more value on knowing the answers. And not just any answer, but very specifically the answer that your examiner has in their examination booklet, right? So by the time we get to the workplace, we've lost the habit of asking questions. We're preoccupied with knowing answers. And what we explain in our book is all about how to build back that habit of questioning, how to create that culture of questioning, what the habits and the rituals are that a business leader can put in place to get everybody questioning and thinking.
Yeah, definitely. I absolutely agree that asking questions is an essential part of every company, really. But then I will now move on to the next part of the book, which is on communication. So, Pippa, what do leaders need to do to ensure effective communication within their businesses?
So there might be a slight irony to asking me this question, because I failed my 7+ because my English was so bad. Later transpired. So fortunately, my parents hadn't totally given up on me, because they thought I was actually quite good with numbers and math. And it transpired later that I was dyslexic. So anyway, I still plowed my path with numbers, science, going into finance. And I still, to be honest, I still struggle with reading, and I wince when people say to me in a personal or business context, what books on your bedside table? Because the honest answer is none, because I really still struggle with reading. And so I find it hard to enjoy. But anyway, I then started working with Jen, and we started poring over board papers. Of course, board papers are long, and I had to get through it, and I just had to consume them. I had to read them. But I was shocked, basically, by what I saw. I was shocked by how badly they were written. And then I was thinking, is this just me? And is this my dyslexia and my struggle with my ability to read? And the answer was no, it wasn't. So Jen was saying, no, you're right, these are badly written too. And in fact, we talked to some executives, and I'll never forget a CFO saying, yeah, no, I can't really understand what was in my last finance report that was submitted to the board that was written by the team. Anyway, so we then started to think about how you break down the problem. How do you break down that problem? What's going wrong in the way that people are communicating? And our view was that convention is getting in the way. So the tenets of good communication that we're taught in school and that are reinforced in the workplace are unhelpful for when it comes to the context of business writing. And we identify in the book that there are 5 key conventions that are getting in the way. And that, in our view, need to be torn up, put in the dustbin, and replaced with 5 better conventions that work. I'm not going to go through them all now, but let me just give you one as an example. So, stories. We're told to write stories with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And it's the end that you wait to pack your punch and do the big unveil. So that doesn't work for business writing. So that convention needs to be relegated, put in the dustbin. We replace it with a convention, which is hit them with the key messages first. And in the military, this is called bluff. So put your bottom line up front, my key messages first. And you can put this into practice with everything. So let's say everyone writes emails. So think about the next email that you write. Instead of starting to build, essentially, to your point with context, background, now I'm going to get to the point at my end, flip it. Think really hard. What's my point? What's the ask? And I'm going to put that first. I'm going to make that the first sentence of my email.
Yeah, I think that's a great tip. I mean, I really believe clear communication is key to actually every aspect of not just business, but life as well. So yeah, again, very important part of the book. And then let's now look at the third part, which is dedicated to focus. So you say that in order for a business to be intelligent, people need to know how to focus while still being able to pivot when needed. So people, again, why is that important, and how can we achieve it?
Many businesses are now global in nature and large. You've got people, lots of people, and lots of people in different places. So organizing them and getting everyone kind of singing from the same hymn sheet, kind of driving in the same direction, is really important. And now more than ever, when we live in a world with a lot of change, being able to change focus is super important. And there's a lovely story in the book. This will be one from Jen and her classics background, from a Roman historian, who basically said, the Romans are shorter, weaker, poorer, and have a lower intellectual capability than their neighbours. Yet what they do have is the ability to get organized. And that trumps everything else in that scenario. So let me give you a kind of business example of where we've seen this, come into play. So EasyJet, a European airline, they appointed a new chief exec, Carolyn McCall. She actually wasn't from the industry, but at the time that she was appointed, oil was spiking over $100 a barrel. There was a volcanic ash cloud over most of Europe. There were strikes happening in many countries where, you know, whether it was ground control or crew who were walking out. So she took over as chief exec, kind of in big time of change, big time of crisis. And one of the first things that she noticed, so EasyJet had been run incredibly successfully based on optimizing cost. So being a low cost airline and being able to deliver that low cost. But what had happened is actually the crew had become quite disaffected. The customers had started to not enjoy the experience. And actually that was then coming out in the financials. So Carolyn needed to pivot the focus of the organization radically and quickly from an organization that had been about profit first to an organization that needed to be about people first, people, customer, and profit kind of as the outcome that would happen in the end. And she did that by changing the priority order and the questions that were asked in the business. So when you open a pack, when you open information, you'd see first people, first and foremost, as the topic that they were going to deal with. And she managed to achieve that kind of from top to bottom of the organization to change that focus.
Yeah, I mean, I just add to that, you know, she became, you know, there's that question that became the centerpiece of the conversation in the organization, which was, how do our people feel and what can we better do to support our people? And they say that if you change the questions, you change the conversation. So as a business leader, when you're trying to achieve focus and you're trying to pivot, you can't be everywhere all at once, right? You can't be in every meeting room. You can't write every manager's plan for the week or their plan for next year, right? You know, you need to let out that rope. And indeed, the more you do, the faster the organization will move. But you need that focus. What you can do is change the questions. You can change the questions that you require every manager in your organization to engage with and to agonize over as they prepare that, whether it's their plan for next year, whether it's their monthly update, their quarterly business review, or their investment proposal for this, that, or the other project. What is the question or the questions that you want them to keep front and center and respond to explicitly in those management reports and such like that they prepare?
Yeah, that's a great story and some great insights that you now share with us. But sometimes, even when you follow all of the tips and the guidance that you cover in the book, there are other factors like belief, perseverance that stop us from achieving collective intelligence. And actually, you finish the book with a chapter about that that's titled When It All Goes Wrong. So, Jennifer, what should leaders do in such situations when everything goes wrong?
Yeah, you're right. So the central thesis of our book is that if you can get everyone in your business at every level to think well, if you can help them to communicate that thinking really clearly so that others can act on it, and if you keep all of this thinking focused on what matters most, great things will happen, right? That's the central thesis, which I think and I hope sounds coherent as well as true. But real life is a whole lot messier than that. And real life just keeps serving up inconvenient examples of where great thinking matched with clear communication and focused on something really important leads nowhere. And there was a temptation to ignore that, right? As sort of an inconvenient truth and to just like, let's just pretend these thoughts and these examples and, you know, this messy truth, let's pretend it wasn't there. But then we go, no, that, you know, let's actually get a grip on this and let's tackle it. So we did. At the end of the book, we do, and we share a story that I think brings to life just how messy real life can be, with the story of Harry Markopoulos. And this is a guy who was a fund manager. He was under enormous pressure from his boss to match the performance of another star fund out there, a fund that was run by some guy called Bernie Madoff, a name now familiar to us all. Anyway, so Harry took a look at Markopoulos' fund and wanted to figure out what was this guy doing that he wasn't and that clearly he should be. And to quote him, he said, "It took me 5 minutes to know it was a fraud. It took me another almost 4 hours of mathematical modelling to prove it was a fraud." Off the back of this, he wrote a crisp 21-page memo. He titled it, "The World's Biggest Hedge Fund is a Fraud. he sent it off to the SEC and nothing happened. Nothing happened. Because the people he shared it with, they just could not get their head around the possibility that Bernie wasn't a good guy. You know, this was a member of the establishment. You know, he couldn't be a fraud. And all the evidence in the world wasn't going to change their minds, not at that point, which is that, you know, the power of belief, perseverance. So our point here is, yes, collective intelligence won't work in pockets. You know, here we had an example of, you know, did Harry Markopoulos engage in critical thinking? Tick. Did he communicate that critical thinking clearly so that that thinking could travel and others could act on it? Tick. You know, was it focused on something that mattered? Tick. Did it work? No. So, you know, great thinking, well communicated, that meets deaf ears, you're not going to get very far. Which means you can't do this in pockets. You've got to get everyone in your organization at every level engaged in critical thinking and willing to tackle the difficult questions, willing and comfortable and familiar questioning everything that you think you know. That has to become the lifeblood of your organization. Otherwise, you'll risk Harry Markopoulos situation. In fact, there's probably a dozen other examples that that I could share of the same, where the theory doesn't meet the practice if you don't get this working institution wide, organization wide.
Yeah, that's a great example of when things really go wrong. And then I have one final question, Pippa. So, what are your top three tips for leaders who want to make their businesses smarter than them? What would be the first steps that they need to take?
Okay, so I'm going to give you one rather than three, but it's a really practical one. So we talk in the book about habits and rituals and how you can hijack them to inject basically this critical thinking, great communication and focus. So everyone will have meetings in their diary. So look forward in your diary and pick a meeting, a set piece that's in your calendar, and isolate the important questions that need to be answered as part of that meeting. I'm just going to give you kind of two examples that are common types of meetings. So it might be a business performance review, and a business performance review might be the type of questions of looking back, looking forward, what's gone well, what hasn't gone well, and what do we need to do about it? Net net, where does that leave us now? And what action do we need to take? That's kind of like a set of questions that one might ask around a kind of business performance review. Another kind of typical type of set piece meeting might be about taking decisions about a proposal. And again, that can follow a set of questions. So what's the need or opportunity? Why do we need to do something now? What are the options that we considered? And against what assessment criteria? What did we discount? What did we pick and why? And what do we need to do next to implement? And what would be the implication of not taking a decision? Those could be the set of questions around a proposal. But anyway, isolate the meeting that's in your calendar and that's important to you. Isolate the set of questions that you think are important that need to be engaged in with that topic. Then share them with everyone who's coming to the meeting and that needs to prepare. And explain that they need to provide answers to those questions in advance of the meeting. And then our hope will be that when you reflect on that meeting, the quality of thinking and the quality of conversation is dramatically different to the last meeting you had on that topic.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Jennifer and Pippa, for taking the time to speak with me today. It was a fascinating conversation that we had about collective intelligence. And I would encourage all of our listeners now to go and buy the book, because there is much more insight and guidance that they will find in there. But thank you very much again.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us today, and thanks everyone for listening. Don't forget to keep an eye on our social media at Lit Publishing on Instagram, Facebook and Twitter, and at Lit Business Media on LinkedIn for more information about new books and podcasts with thought leaders. We are now also on TikTok, so make sure you follow us at Lit Publishing. See you next time on Lit Radio Podcast.